Okay, are we ready to get going again? The next agenda item that we have today is around disclosures for our project on financial instruments with the characteristics of equity. And who am I handing over to, Rhianna or Angie or to Uni? Over to you, Uni.
Thanks, Nick, and good morning, CMEC members. I hope all of you are well. The purpose of the session today is to gather views from CMEC members on how the board can refine its proposed disclosures on financial instruments issued by companies. We have set out in this pack the key features of three types of disclosures that were proposed in the FICE discussion paper published in 2018, and the summary of the feedback received on each of them. This includes, obviously, the feedback received from CMEC members at previous meetings. Based on the feedback received, the staff are exploring how those disclosure proposals can be refined so that they can be more useful to investors while achieving a cost-benefit balance. We would like to highlight the potential refinements set out in this pack is preliminary ideas of this stuff, and the board has not yet made any decisions on them. This means the disclosure the board may ultimately decide on might look different from what's set out in here. However, the feedback you provide today would be highly valuable inputs in shaping what the future disclosures in this area might look like. So today, Angie and I will be briefly teeing up each of the three sections rather than going through every slide before turning it over to CMEC members for discussion. I will do the first disclosure and Angie will take you through the second and the third ones. So the first one is about priority of financial liabilities and equity instruments on liquidation of the issuer, which are set out on slides 8 to 11. Slide 8 sets out key messages we've heard from various types of stakeholders when the 2018 FICE discussion paper was published. One of the biggest points that we heard from preparers and also from investors as a key challenge was that it would be very difficult to provide and understand this information on a consolidated group basis for the reasons highlighted on this slide. Also, many raised the point about priority of financial instruments on liquidation is heavily influenced by the laws of the relevant jurisdictions. And providing this disclosure, considering only the contractual terms, would not provide the full picture. To address these concerns, we are exploring a number of potential refinements as set out on slide number 9. And on slide number 10, to help illustrate what that refinements mean, we have provided a simple example. So this disclosure would be provided in the notes to the financial statements, and we'd expect it would be provided in a table that shows financial instruments issued by the parent and material subsidiaries in order of their priority on liquidation of each of the issuer entity. While it may alleviate the concern about having to provide this information on a consolidated basis, it means that consolidated picture will not be provided. To fill this gap, at least partly, a narrative description of intercompany guarantee arrangement would be disclosed, as shown as the last bullet point on this slide. And to help further supplement the table, which will be provided only for financial instruments and purely on a contractual terms basis, we are thinking of narrative descriptions such as those provided under the table on slide number 10. For example, a company would highlight that they have other liabilities that are non-financial that may take higher priority on liquidation. And they would also highlight the priority taking into account the legal perspective may be different. We appreciate this will not provide all the information you may need, but we are hoping this can act as an alert that investors can use to question management and seek further information. We think it is a reasonable way to balance the need for information and the potential challenges and complexity of providing this information beyond financial instruments and beyond contractual term. But obviously, we are very much interested in your view on how useful these will be. So, on slide number 11, we have a list of questions for you. In essence, we would like to understand whether the potential refinements explored on slide 9 would provide useful information for you, and we are interested in any other suggestions you might have. And if possible, we would like to understand for what kind of analysis you'd use this information so that we can progress making our refinements, bearing that in mind. So now I will turn it over to CMEC members for comments. Thank you.
Thanks for the introduction, Uni. So this is about information about priority on liquidation and potential refinements to our proposals. So as before, those of you who are on video, if you could indicate if you'd like to speak to this question. Philip. And those who are on the phone, and Rosemary as well. Thank you, Rosemary. And those on the phone. Okay, Philip, why don't you start off then, please? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. I mean, obviously, I'm probably the only credit analyst left now on CMEC, but have always been very supportive of these disclosures and insisting how useful they are. In many ways, actually, the parent in situ disclosure is probably more useful than the consolidated basis. So, just to say, very happy with that.
Okay, thank you, Philip. Can I just remind everyone, if you're not speaking, to mute, please? I am picking up some background noise, certainly at my end. So if you're not speaking, please be on mute. Rosemary, over to you.
Thank you. I agree with what Philip already said. So I agree. I'm very supportive of the disclosure, your suggestions. And again, as a private investor, we see liquidation and so on sort of pops up more than perhaps in the listed companies. And so having the priority and the segregation, the information that you're providing, I think would be very helpful to someone that invests, especially in sort of the private sector. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary. Anyone else, either on video or dialing in, would like to speak to this question? Thanks. Anthony, over to you.
I just wanted to say this is excellent. Thanks.
That's always good to hear. You can come again. And Sue.
Let's see if you're going to let me come again. The reason why we're asking this question, so I'd be just interested in some feedback on this point, is that I think the proposals in the discussion paper suggested looking at the priority and liquidation based on a consolidated perspective, and a lot of people came back and told us that they questioned the usefulness of that, which is why the staff are now suggesting this individual entity approach, which to me sounds sensible. But I just wanted to confirm with people that even though that means there'll sort of be a bit of a potential disconnect between the notes and what you'd see in the consolidated financial statements, you still think that's useful, because I think that's the pushback we might need to be prepared to respond to.
Any thoughts on Sue's question? Thanks, Philip.
Just wondering, so will there not be any sort of reconciliation to be able to tie it all together? Because just talking about the management performance measures, that's the route we're going down. But just wondered if you had thoughts there.
Just a question, Sue, there, whether there'd be any kind of reconciliation to tie that information together.
I'll let Uni answer.
So I think because our proposal at the moment, not sorry, not the proposal, but the preliminary thinking that we have at the moment is for this disclosure to be provided for the parent and material subsidiaries. So, which means while the numbers that you see in the notes that provides this priority information, you will see a measure the good coverage of what you would see if you compare the total of that number to what you see in the financial statement. We would like to think that parent plus material subsidiary disclosure will provide good coverage, but you might not be able to reconcile directly to the face of financial statements because this disclosure will be provided for the parent and material subsidiaries only.
But I guess if we needed to, you're just thinking on the hoof, that if there was a significant difference between what was in the notes and it was difficult to sort of tie back to the consolidated financial statements, which I think would probably mainly be if you had anything sort of significant on an intra-group basis, a reconciliation, if that was necessary to aid explanation, might not be a bad thing to think about.
Yes, it is possible to do that, if that's important for you.
I think it would be helpful if it's something you can consider, yes. So, you know, just okay. to pull the information together and just to, you know, just some reassurance, I suppose, that what you're looking at in the notes actually is what's in the balance sheet.
Thanks, Philip. Mary, did you have a comment?
It's more a question or pointing back to a question that Uni asked at the end of her tee up that's not on the list on slide 11, which is it would be useful if we could use today's discussion to get more information about the kind of analysis that you would do using this type of information, because as Sue said, if there's pushback, I think it's useful to be able to say whether this is something that is particularly important for credit analysts, although it's also used for those who may be equity investors, et cetera. If people have any comments in response to, Uni's question and her tee up and just an indication of how important do you think it is, that would be helpful. Thank you.
So we've heard from both some credit and equity investors, but let's, as Philip pointed out, he's probably his sole credit investor now, I think I'm seeing, I'm not sure. But let's first of all, is there any other equity investors who would like to speak to whether this would help them in terms of the proposal here?
Jeremy.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Linking to the previous point, it would be very helpful on slide 10 to have a consolidated column, and even if there's an extra column saying other and eliminations, extra column, so we can trace it back. My point is this table we're defining for material subsidiaries, but should it not be for subsidiaries with material perpetual bonds or material notes? So I'm thinking of an example where there's a very small subsidiary but could have very significant amounts of perpetual bonds or preference shares, for example.
Guidance on what material should mean in these circumstances.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, Sue. Anyone else want to come in response to Mary's question? Philip.
I can speak very, very quickly, Mary. I mean, it's something that we would try to do anyway as part of the credit analysis process. So it's much better if we have the company do it for us, frankly.
Thanks, Philip. If there are no further contributions on this particular set of disclosures, shall we move on then to talk about potential dilution?
Right. Good morning, everyone. So let's move on to slide number 12, which are the potential dilution disclosures, which applies to financial instruments that may be settled in own shares. So on slide 13, we highlight the challenges that stakeholders raised including the concern that there is overlap with information in IAS 33. And for this reason, we looked at the diluted earnings per share requirements in IAS 33, and these are summarized in the appendix just for information purposes. So on slide 14, we explain that the diluted earnings per share calculations aim to maximize the dilution of basic earnings per share, and they contain various requirements and assumptions for the calculations depending on the type of potential ordinary shares. So for example, there's different requirements for options and warrants and for contingently issuable shares. Now, the maximum number that was proposed in the DP is different from the number used in the diluted earnings per share calculation, because it takes into account potential increases in the number of issued ordinary shares, regardless of the current conditions at the reporting date. So therefore, different assumptions are used in coming up with the maximum number. You'll see on slide 15 that we list potential refinements to the proposals in the DP. So instead of a reconciliation of your opening to closing balance, we consider disclosing the maximum number of additional ordinary shares just at the end of the reporting period, and an explanation of significant changes compared to the prior period, and information also about the key terms and conditions. And in addition, we consider as a simplification, cross-reference to the relevant IFRS 2 disclosures. And this is because including IFRS 2 instruments that may be settled in shares in the maximum number of additional ordinary shares would require additional assumptions, which may differ from those used in the diluted earnings per share calculation, and also additional disclosures to those that are already required in IFRS 2. So that could add a lot more complexity. On slide 16 to 18, we discuss how this maximum number would be calculated using assumptions that are different from those used for the diluted earnings per share calculations. So if you'll have a look at slide 17, for example, we look at three convertible bonds with different features. So convertible bond A has a conversion ratio, which is adjusted based on a contingent event occurring. And to calculate the maximum number of additional ordinary shares, we would assume that the contingent event occurs, and we'd use the adjusted conversion ratio. In another example, if we look at convertible bond B, so assuming that that is anti-dilutive at the reporting date, it would still be included in our calculation of the maximum number. So the maximum number would take into account that it may become dilutive in the future. And in convertible bond C, where the issuer here has a choice of settlement in cash or in shares if the holder exercises the conversion option, we will assume settlement in shares when we calculate the maximum number. So now if I turn to slide 19, there are some questions that we'd like to ask CMAC members. And the first question is if the potential disclosure refinements would provide useful information for users of financial statements, and if yes, for what purpose you'd intend to use this information. The second question is about specifically whether disclosing a minimum number of additional ordinary shares would be useful. That was one of the suggestions also that came up in the feedback, but I'd just like to point out that different assumptions would again be needed if we're going to be determining maximum and minimum numbers. And again, these assumptions could differ from those used in the diluted earnings per share calculation, which could add complexity for both preparers and users of financial statements. And in addition, you always have the possibility that options will not be exercised regardless of which assumptions would be used. And then the last question on slide 19 is whether disclosure would be useful if provided only by listed entities. So I'll now turn over to CMAC members for comments.
Thanks, Angie. So a number of questions in that section are so shown on page 19. So if you're on the VC, can you again indicate by raising your hand if you'd like to speak to this section? And if you're dialing in.
Joel here, please.
Sorry, who was that?
Joel.
Joel, excellent.
And Paul, I'll say a couple of things on that.
Yep. Okay, Joel, why don't you start us, please?
Okay, so on the proposal in general, I think this information is very useful. I definitely support that. I think the understanding of investors and market participants of the dilution impact on prices and returns is quite limited. I think more information around that is important. There are definitely houses that try to explore systematic strategies around the dilution effect and the share price impact around that. So I think having a better understanding and better disclosure around those numbers would be very significant and would be very positive. In terms of that disclosure, and I understand, of course, the balancing of that with the complexity that it would generate, but I think the question on whether a minimum number would add relevant information, I think that's a definite yes as well. So having the range of dilution would be the ideal information, I think. And just a final point is that on the answer to the last question, I think it is, at least from my perspective, from where I'm speaking, this would be something relevant for listed entities only, basically, because from where I'm looking, at least, I know there'll be other angles on that, but from where I'm looking, it is the impact on share prices and returns that I'm concerned about. So it would be only relevant for listed entities.
Thanks, Joe. And just a follow-up from me. The suggestion that we would link the potential dilution of instruments relating to IFRS 2 by way of a narrative description, would that be sufficient for you?
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful already, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks, then. Paul, and then Coy afterwards. Thank you.
So I'd agree with a lot of what was just said. I was going to talk about the minimum and maximum issue, which is probably the one area where I perhaps have a slightly different view from Joao. So I think, although it's quite a stern test that you're setting, insisting on the disclosure of the maximum is the right way to go. And I also think you do not need to require a disclosure of the minimum. And again, it comes back to that point that preparers will work quite hard to explain to us why it is that maximum is not the right number that we should be looking at and what the parameters are around it. If you require the maximum, then we'll get the maximum level of disclosure and explanation from the companies. If you don't require the maximum, then I think the level of transparency would be reduced, and I think that would be a shame. I certainly think that preparers will work pretty hard to explain to us what a more realistic expectation is around the level of dilution. And you know, the examples that you give on slide 17, no doubt they would explain exactly why it is that we should look at a lower number in each of those cases. But again, that discussion, that transparency would be very useful to us.
Thanks, Paul. Coy?
Thank you. I think that the example in slide 17 provides information on maximum potential dilution, but does not include any information on the likelihood of dilution. I believe that users want information on the likelihood of dilution as well as maximum potential dilution. I think that we will be able to estimate the likelihood of dilution based on the past trend by using the reconciliation table. So I believe such reconciliation table have a utility that outweighs the cost of preparers. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Coy. Uni, you want to come back in?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Koi, if you, when you say reconciliation, I just wanted to clarify reconciliation between what and what. Are you talking about the reconciliation from the opening to the closing balance, or is there some other reconciliation you have in mind?
Yes, I need the reconciliation table from beginning to end. That reconciliation table. I understand by using the reconciliation table, we understand the possibility of dilution.
Thank you, Koi. Sue, you wanted to come back in, I think.
Yes, please. I wanted to ask a couple of questions to prepare us for the conversations that are likely to follow if we went ahead with these proposals, which seems sensible to me, but just to make sure we understand your perspective so we can explain it. One is, I think some preparers have suggested that if we just focus on financial instruments and not share-based payments, that because the information would be complete, it sort of negates the usefulness of providing this information at all. And so they would use that as a rationale for why we shouldn't require these disclosures. So I guess a little bit more understanding of whether indeed IFRS 2 sort of narrative description would be sufficient and why it would be sufficient to give a full picture, I think might be useful for us. And also on the point of the of whether it should only be listed entities that provide this information. I think some people suggested that when they came back to us, because that's the scope, I think, of our earnings per share standard at the moment, so they use that as the sort of rationale. But if I was a shareholder in an unlisted company, I would think I would still be interested in any potential dilution that might come in from convertible bonds being issued or things like that when I'm making investment decisions. So I just wondered why we might think that it wasn't as relevant for an unlisted entity. Is it because we think they could get information directly so they're not the sort of standard primary user, or what's the sort of basis for being comfortable with that?
Thanks, Sue. Do we have, I can see Rosemary. Let's go to Rosemary first then, and I'll come back to others. Rosemary, thank you.
Yeah, so a couple of things. On your last point, should private companies or not listed companies provide that same information? I agree with you. I think it absolutely should be there. We do look at that information. We look at it pretty closely. So my thinking was, well, if it's, you know, if they can't disclose or it's difficult or you get pushback, we can get that information generally through our due diligence and so on. But if we could, if it can be provided, absolutely, we agree it should be for listed and non-listed companies. And to your point, we look at it not just from an EPS, but also from, liquidation preference, the implication of, as you say, issuing a, convertible bond and so on and so forth. Your comment on IFRS 2, actually, I had a clarification question there. So the question is, I guess, since you're proposing a disclosure, what was the thinking for proposing disclosure versus, including it as you would sort of the other other instruments?
A narrative, you mean?
Pardon?
Proposing a narrative disclosure only.
That's right. Because I agree with you. You probably would like to have it just like you have the other other instruments. So I just was curious as to why there's a narrative versus the disclosure.
I think that the staff are rightfully wary of scope creep for the project. So this is a project about financial instruments accounting. People have rightly pointed out that options and things are issued for other reasons, including share-based payments, and it would seem that it would be ideal to have a complete picture. So I think the proposal here, speaking hopefully correctly on behalf of the staff, is that this is a way of balancing, not going overboard in terms of requiring too much for share-based payments, which is a separate standard and has already quite comprehensive disclosure requirements in the context of a financial instruments project. So trying to find a balance between those sort of competing objectives.
Okay, thank you. That's good, thanks.
Yes, if I may just add to include the share-based payment numbers as you would see in the table, as you would see other items, we had to make an assumption, apply the assumption that is different from the assumptions used to provide the share-based payment disclosures, and also different the assumptions from what is used to provide the diluted earnings per share information. So having different assumptions for three different types of disclosure for the same instrument, we thought it might be confusing to users to understand and apply different assumptions when looking at all those different disclosures. But we would be interested in your thinking that even with those different assumptions, whether you would still like to see that in the table as with other items.
So are there any further views on those two questions? One around whether it would be fine to describe the dilution from IFRS 2 in a narrative sense, or whether it would be better to have it in a single table. And then again, the question around whether this should only apply to listed entities. So Mary, do you want to come in, Mary?
Well, I think I'm going to pile in on the second half of the question that Sue asked about only listed entities, because, for example, when John was speaking, he was talking about using this information for a strategy that was around share price movement, and that's why he was focused on listed companies only. And certainly, I think of some discussions, including from a number of years ago with Jeremy, I heard concern about participation curves and understanding how an investor's participation might be changed by dilution, potential dilution. So I guess it's just asking CMAC members if they could weigh in about whether the type of disclosures here would be directly useful or maybe only indirectly useful or not useful at all in terms of understanding dilution of economic interest rather than just share price.
So Rosemary, I've got Rosemary wants to come back in. Anyone else on video who wants to come in on that? And then anyone who's dialing in? Okay, over to you, Rosemary.
Okay, so I completely agree that the participation or how an investor might be diluted based on various instruments that have been issued absolutely is something that we definitely look at. So, to answer your question, absolutely, I this information is useful. It's not just for earnings per share, but for how one participates. And it's something that, again, we look at very closely. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but I would say yes, that I think the information is important. Again, if it's going to be difficult for non-listed, if you get a lot of pushback, I guess that's information we can gather in other ways. But, if we can get the companies that are not listed on exchanges to include, I think that would be very helpful and useful information. So I hope I've answered your question.
Thanks, Rosemary. Mary? Oh, you've answered the question. I think there was a thumbs up, I think. excellent. Two thumbs up. Any other perspectives from CMAC members on the issues, disclosures around potential dilution before we move on to the third issue?
Perhaps just a clarification, more of a question than a comment to draw here again. I think, from my perspective and other perspectives have been mentioned already, but the total dilution is really the ultimate number that I think a lot of investors, myself included, would be interested in. So on the point of different sets of disclosures or different sets of dilution numbers being put together on the share-based payment side and on this proposal, I'm not sure I follow why a table putting all of those together would add too much complexity. Perhaps a bit more on that would be useful.
Thanks. Any particular feedback? Go ahead.
Maybe I'll just add. So I think it's mainly the issue about the scope creep that we were concerned about. In looking at the diluted earnings per share calculations, there are specific requirements for IFRS 2 instruments. So, for example, if the shares just have service conditions, they haven't yet vested, you treat them as options. But if there's a performance condition attached, you would treat it as contingently issuable shares. And so while that assumption might be similar for diluted earnings, and if we're looking at including it in the maximum number, we might use different assumptions. So for the contingently issuable shares, we would assume the contingency is met. Whereas in IAS 33, you would have to look at if the end of the reporting period was the end of the contingency period, and only if it's met at that point, then you would include it. So just thinking there's a lot of different assumptions. There also could be some issues around classification, just that people could get confused. Like if you think about IFRS 2 looks at when something will be settled in shares or in cash, there's different rules depending on whether it's the issuer's option or the holder's option or both options, both parties could choose to settle. And although that's a classification issue, I'm just thinking it might be different also from the IAS 33 assumptions where when something is settled in ordinary shares or cash, if the entity has the option, then you would assume it's settled in shares. If the holder has the option, you would have to look at the more dilutive. So just those are just some examples that when we are looking at it, it could add a lot of complexity if there's different rules for maximum number, different rules for dilution. And then IFRS 2 itself has a number of disclosure requirements, even for listing things by reconciliations for the granted exercisable, when's the weighted average exercise price. So we just thought all of this is adding a lot of complexity if we were to include it, but it was mainly also the issue about the scope.
Okay, thank you. I think that helps. I would just make the comment that I think for a lot of investors, what they will end up doing is make their own calculations, adding those different dilution drivers, basically. And I think ultimately it will be a lot harder for investors to make that calculation than for the company themselves, to give them the maximum number and to know when those different assumptions overlap and when one negates another and so on. So I think ultimately, despite the complexity, I think it would be more useful to have the company giving those assumptions, and you would end up with a much more precise number than investors making the calculation themselves.
Thanks, Joel. Uni.
Before we move on to next one, very quickly, I think we've heard from Koi that the reconciliation from the opening and closing numbers, which will show all the instruments, potentially dilutive instrument issued during the year and at what day, then what were the potential dilutive effect of those would be in a table that shows kind of in a date order. So that was the proposal in a discussion paper. But now we are thinking about whether this disclosure should focus on whatever that instruments that's outstanding as at the end of reporting period. So does anybody else think that reconciliation that shows movement during the year important, and would you like to see that as opposed to the year-end or reporting date picture.
Any Rosemary, did you want to speak to that?
I was just correct. I was just scratching my eye, but I could. I mean, I understand Kohei's perspective. From my perspective, I think end of a reporting period is fine. But I'm sure there's other reasons why others might want to see the reconciliation during the year. But I'd be fine with just as at the reporting date.
Thanks, Rosemary. Any other views before we move on to the last question or set of questions? No, I'll take that as being, unless others speak out, I'll take that as being no strong view about the need for a reconciliation.
Yeah, to my perspective, end of the reporting period would be fine as well.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's move on to the final area then, please.
Okay, so let's now turn to slide number 21. This slide recaps feedback from stakeholders on the proposed disclosures in the DP for terms and conditions. And the main concern related to disclosure overload, especially for multinational entities which have many issued instruments or regulated entities that are already required to provide similar information. On slide 22, we highlight potential refinements to the proposals in the DP, and is really to focus the disclosures on significant financial liabilities and equity instruments, particularly those where classification involves significant judgment, so that users of financial statements can understand the key features that led to the classification. And we also note that information about key terms and conditions that affect the nature, the timing, the amount, and the uncertainty of future cash flows, as well as information about voting rights, would be useful. So on slide 23, we provide a simplified example of a perpetual bond and what information could be provided to show the key terms and conditions that affect the cash flows on the bond, as well as the key features that led to its classification, as well as any voting rights or the fact that they have no voting rights. Then on slide 24, we have some questions for CMAC members. The first question is whether the potential disclosure requirements provide useful information for users of financial statements, and if so, for what purpose the information is intended to be used. And the final question is whether there's any particular types of terms and conditions that you would like companies to disclose in further detail. So I'll now hand over to CMAC members for discussion.
Thanks, Angie. So let's start with those who are on video. So if you could raise a hand if you'd like to speak to the questions in this section on terms and conditions. Okay, no one on video. And Philip, thank you. And amongst those of you who are dialing in,
Jeremy here.
Thank you, Jeremy. Philip, let's start with you then. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Nick. I'll be very quick. I'm really just to say very supportive. You know, I think it's always useful to know what, liabilities or equity the company has, depends how it's classified. I mean, to be honest, for us, that's probably less relevant than knowing exactly what the terms and conditions of an instrument are, so that we can make our own assessment. So, you know, any disclosure in that area, I think, is fantastic. So, very supportive.
Thanks, Philip. Jeremy?
Just from an equity analyst perspective, the main use case for me would be to perform scenario analysis in different, if things go really well or really, or different situations, what would the equity valuation look like? In terms of specific terms and conditions, early repayment fees or penalties would be interesting, but sometimes hard to find. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeremy. Any other views or observations around disclosure in this area? Florian. And then Mary.
Yeah, just, I mean, from our side, I think it's a helpful disclosure so we don't have to dig through the individual term sheets of the bonds or whatever else is outstanding. And obviously, the from an equity perspective, the question for us, we're always kind of trying to dig through is things about debt covenants and these types of things. So not so much the repayment, but at what time, at what point in time do they get into difficulties with their lenders and have to make good or something. So debt covenants and these types of disclosures is what we are normally looking for if we go through the terms and conditions of bond instruments or loans.
Great, thank you. Mary?
Jeremy, just a follow-up on your point, if I can. You were talking about using the terms and conditions information for scenario analysis, and I'm going back to the last time I invoked your name without your permission in the dilution discussion. Would you put more importance on the terms and conditions rather than the dilution to understand different scenario analyses, or am I inappropriately conflating two types of analysis that you might want to do?
Oh, thanks, Mary. I suppose I was a particular example I had in mind from my own experience where it was the early repayment of a financial instrument was a material cash flow at a time when the cash flow was under stress. So that would be the most important in that situation. But I'm not sure if I've got a general answer to your question about what's more important. But in my mind, it fits in the general category of important things to know when you're performing scenario analysis, including continued consideration and other related things.
Helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Any other comments or observations on this area of disclosure? Or indeed, anything else that we have discussed in this paper? Any particular areas where the staff would like to see further clarification, or do you have enough information from CMAC members?
I did have one question. It's just something that was raised from one of the stakeholders on the priority. So I know we were discussing earlier about having a reconciliation to the consolidated financial statements, but there was actually some feedback that, you know, is it even necessary to show any quantitative information? Because like if you So they preferred carrying amounts to fair values because there's difficulties in working out the fair values. But a lot of, but there were some stakeholders that mentioned that, you know, on liquidation, it's the recoverability values that are also more important than even fair values or carrying values. So there was a suggestion that there be no quantitative information, just like a listing, I guess, of the priority on liquidation without any numbers. I just wanted to find out if there was any appetite for that at all.
So any appetite for disclosure in terms of priorities, which is simply a list, a narrative, a list rather than any numbers included? Philip, thank you. And then Rosemary.
I think I'd prefer numbers ultimately, you know, even if it is just the carrying amount. And I mean, ultimately, what we're probably trying to do and what a bond rating ultimately conveys is what is the recoverability if two things. How likely is the bond to default for which the order of priority is very important, and also the terms and conditions on the last slide that we had. But obviously, once it has defaulted, the second element of the rating is what's the recoverability, which is an assessment that we'll make. I don't know if that's something the company would want to provide. I think maybe that is a step too far. But, I just think in terms of reconciling and tying everything together, it's helpful to have the numbers rather than just a list of the instruments. But that's personal view.
Thanks, Philip. Rosemary?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with what Philip said.
Okay, excellent. Mary?
this is making it up on the fly, but as I think about today's discussion, I think I'd be very interested in hearing from all the CMAQ members participating, if possible, is there one of the three areas that we've talked about that really stands out from your perspective as the single most important thing that we should be focusing on? I'm not suggesting that we can only do one of these three, but I would be very interested in understanding, okay, I'll make a bad accounting joke here, your priorities about, about these disclosure points that we're discussing. Is there anything that you see as particularly critical to the types of analysis? And if we could only do one, what would you encourage us to focus on the most?
Okay, so well, I'm going to ask everyone. so you're free to pass if you want to, but we don't normally have straw polls. But let's go through this. So if you can only have, let's keep it to the three areas. So priority on liquidation, dilution, terms and conditions. And I'm cognizant we may get a credit equity split here, but let's ask the question all the same. And I say you can pass if you'd like to. So Philip, let's start with you.
Thanks, Nick. I would go for priority on liquidation would be my priority. But yes, to be honest, dilution, less relevant, terms and conditions we'll probably have from elsewhere. So I think priority on liquidation for me, quite clearly.
Thanks. Bertram? Seem to have lost Bertram. Jeremy?
From an equity perspective, the terms and conditions.
Okay, thank you. Marietta?
Well, I think it's very hard to say because it really depends a lot on the company and the sector. There are probably some companies where it wants the dilution more and some companies where, you know, it wants the priority of liquidation more. I mean, I think it probably for most companies that have sort of reasonably straight debt and lots of it, the priority of liquidation is more important. And so I can see, you know, where Philip, for example, is coming from. But like, especially in the biotech space, I think for most of the companies, if I had to just pick one of them, I would say actually the dilution, because it's just so hard to work out and a lot of times such a bottomless pit. So yeah, I don't know if that helps, but I'm basically saying you should go for all three.
Okay, thanks, Marietta. Paul?
Yeah, I think I would go for dilution as well. Probably, I mean, and as you said, there probably is a bit of an equity debt split in the comments. But I think I'd tend to go for the dilution mostly because that would probably drive the best disclosure from the companies, and give us most of the range of information that we'd want. I think other routes might tend to bury more things, but you know, I think it's quite an unfair question for us. That I think most of us would want all three.
It's never stopped Mary before. Rosemary.
I guess, as everybody said, I think all three would be best. But if I had to choose one, perhaps terms and conditions. And that assumes that there'll be disclosure of triggering events and so on. And if you have all of that, then you can probably figure out the priority and you can figure out the dilution, albeit it's, you know, lots of calculations and so on. But if I had to only pick one, I might go with terms and conditions, because hopefully I'll have all the information to figure out the other two.
Thanks, Rosemary. Florin?
Terms and conditions, clearly, and least is dilution, because I think what was clear throughout the discussion is we actually have a lot of other disclosures at other points on dilution issues. So terms and conditions first, and then liquidation preference.
Thank you. Yo, Joe?
I think from the things I was raising before, should really my preference for dilution, but yeah, obviously we can have all three, all the data, but only one dilution.
Understood. Thank you. Sunil?
Nick, Sunil has had to log out, so he may log back in when his connection stabilizes.
Okay, understood. Thanks, Fred. Koi? Can't hear you at the moment. I think, Koi, you're still muted. Can you try again?
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah. So do you have a preference between these three categories of disclosure that we've talked about, whether it's priority on liquidation, dilution, or terms and conditions?
Well, I almost agree the disposal.
Okay, so you'd like all three?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And then Anthony?
Thank you. So I assume we're only looking to prioritize just so we don't get a lot of pushback from preparers. Is that kind of the idea?
I think this is really Mary just trying to do a straw poll. I think the board is most likely to try and pursue all three ideas, but just trying to get a sense of relative strength of feeling amongst this group. So this isn't an exercise in choosing per se. Let's say.
Okay. Here's how I would describe it then. So I like the comments that said to give the emphasis on terms and conditions, because then I can do the calculation on the other two, and I might be able to give some Canadian color as well, disclosure on a lot of complex financial instruments, and you know, even debt covenants is terrible in Canada. The companies don't provide it. So having those details with, and I think we can't make it too broad. We have to be specific. So you might be able to get all three by saying terms and conditions, including, you know, priority over liquidation, dilution terms, et cetera. And if we spell those out, then we might be able to capture it with just one sort of, as one layout, as one request. So that's how I would prioritize. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. So can I just ask the staff, we're just about out of time. Have you got enough from us today on this to help you in terms of next steps?
Yes, we have. Thanks very much for very useful input. We will be working hard to make this happen.
Great. So my thanks to Uni and Angie for updating us on our work here. We will take a 15-minute break now, and if everyone could be back promptly at 12:55 UK time, that would be fantastic. And just to remind you again that the webcast will continue live during that break. Thank you.